Parshas Tzav. Because this is very close to Pesach, we're going to do, instead of actually doing the Chumash in Tzav, we'll take some of the Chumash in Shemos, which is applicable to the issues of Yetzias Mitzrayim, of seeing the Makos, and trying to get a perspective on this. And as an introduction, I'd like to begin with one observation. In the beginning of Bo, the Pesach says, Loman tesaper bozne bincho bemincha es asher salalti bimitzrayim. Hashem says to Moshe, I'm going to send you now to Paro. I'm going to harden his heart. And I'm going to send you now, and I'm going to have you bring various oso signs to him. Now the Suno explains that Moshe Rabbeinu did not see any advantage, any reason at this point to continue the Makos. This is already by Arba. This is 7 months into the whole routine. Moshe Rabbeinu already came six times, seven times, each time bringing a clear indication that Hashem created and runs the world, and each time Paro refused to listen. So at that point, Moshe Rabbeinu said to Hashem, why are we doing this? Paro's not listening anyway, why do it? So the Surah explains that these two psukim in the beginning of Bo answer that question. What Hashem says to Moshe is, I'm doing this in order to show my signs, in order that you tell your children and your children's children that which is halalti b'mitzrayim, that I played with Mitzrayim, v'yedatem kini Hashem, and you will know that I am Hashem. It's not for Paro. Explains the Sforno, the reason you're to do this is for the Mitzrim, for the Jews of the generation, and for you. I'm going to demonstrate complete control over every facet of physicality. I'm going to demonstrate that I am the Creator, so that you should see it, so that the people in your generation should see it, and so that the Mitzrim should see it. And this Sforno is very, very intriguing. Why? Because it's obvious why the Mitzrim should see this. Hashem still loves every one of his creations, and even though the Mitzrim were Meshabed, even though they were the ones who oppressed and caused the Jews much pain, still Hashem wanted them to do tshuva. I understand that. I even understand why Hashem would want the Jewish people of that time to see Hashem. Why? Because seeing Hashem more clearly will help them become the Torah nation. But why does Moshe have to see these signs? Why does Moshe have to see additional makos? He already knows Hashem. The Pasuk says, I'm going to do this via datem kini Hashem so that you will know that I'm Hashem. Moshe Rabbeinu knows that. Months ago, Hashem appeared to Moshe in the Sneh. Moshe at that time was 80 years old. And Moshe was a Novi. Moshe was a tremendous Chacham. The Ramban explains that even though it might be that Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't yet on the absolute level, because he hadn't yet gone up to Shemayim to receive the Torah, he was a person of tremendous, tremendous stature, and he knew Hashem. What do you mean now, v'yadatem kin Hashem, now you'll know that I'm Hashem? And Moshe Rabbeinu surely doesn't need this. And I believe the answer to this is that we make a fundamental mistake about Emuna. People think Emuna means, I believe. I believe you. Don't believe. This one is a Baal Mamin. This one isn't a Mamin. Emuna is not an on or off switch. Emuna has many, many levels to it. There's 2%, 5%, 10%, 20%. Emuna is gradient. Emuna is a sense of knowing more clearly, more clearly, more clearly still, and seeing Hashem ever present in your world. If you say the words, I'm a Mamin, that's really not an apt description. What level of clarity do you see Hashem with? And let me give you a mushal to what I mean. Imagine you're on the balcony of a hotel. Fourth floor, you're looking out on the street, interesting patterns of traffic, interesting scenery, and you kind of lean over a little bit to get a better close look, and you lean over, all of a sudden a wind comes, and you almost, oh my goodness, I almost fell. Oh my goodness, I almost fell 45 feet below to the concrete. And here's the point. You don't believe that you would have gotten hurt. You don't think that falling 45 feet to the concrete might have damaged you. You know it. With the Yediyah Gemura, with a total, complete knowledge, you know that falling four stories to the street below is going to end badly. That knowledge, Emuna, on its highest level, is Yediyah, knowing Hashem. Moshe Rabbeinu, at the end of his days, saw Bas Baklari HaMe'iri with total clarity, meaning total, total knowledge. When we say we have Emuna, really what we mean is we see a percentage, 2%, 10%, 15%, but it's a constant growth pattern. And what Hashem was saying to Moshe Rabbeinu over here, I believe, was really quite simple. Yes, you see me to a very great extent, but there are higher levels that even you, Moshe, can reach. And when you live through Arba, when you live through Choshech, when you live through Makas Bechoros, and finally Kriyas Yamsuf, you, Moshe, will see me, Hashem says, more clearly, because even you can grow in Anamuna. And I believe that this concept is fundamental. You see, Chazal tell us, Chayav Adam Lira says, Atzmo Kilu Hu Yatzam Mitzrayim, we're obligated to see ourselves as if we left Mitzrayim. The Ramban in the end of Bo points out that there are many, many mitzvahs, 19 of them, that remind us about the fact that Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim. Why in the world do we need 19 separate mitzvahs to remind us? And the answer is because it's not a fact that we have to remember. It's a feeling, being margish it, experiencing it, and feeling like I was there and I see what Hashem did. Oh my goodness, Hashem turned the water into blood. And when I feel that, I experience Hashem's presence. I'm aware of the fact that Hashem is here, and it changes my reality. And these are things that you can't just come about once in a while to think about. We put on tefillin every day. We say Shema twice a day. We have mezuzahs on our doors and tzitzits on our clothing to constantly remind us, because it's a constant growth pattern, a constant focusing, so that we see it more clearly, and more clearly still. Probably the main focus of Pesach, and certainly the Seder, is Viganata Lebincha, telling over to your child what happened. And people make a mistake. They think what that means is saying over to my child so my child should know. Now, certainly that's a big part. That's obviously the focal point of the mitzvah. But I, too, am a child. Meaning it's not supposed to be children's stories, and it's not supposed to be telling over to my child so my child can know. It's experiential for me as well. If Moshe Rabbeinu, despite the fact that even at this point he was a Novi Hashem, needed more and more, that's something that surely we need. And living through the Seder is supposed to be an emotional experience where we see Hashem more clearly and we understand things on a greater and higher level. And the Ramban in the end of Bo also explains to us why this is so central, why it is that we have 19 mitzvahs, and why this is so integral to everything we do. Explains the Ramban that Hashem is not in the miracle-making business. If you go to the circus, you'll see the performer put on the show one night in this town, the next night in that town. Every night, like clockwork, the performer puts on his performance. Hashem is not in the miracle-making business. Hashem is not a performer. One time in history, Hashem showed the world, I am the one who created, orchestrates, and maintains physicality. That one time was Yetzias Mitzrayim. At that moment in history, Hashem was saying, I will reveal myself and you will see Ki Ani Hashem. You see, there are three pillars to our emuna. The first pillar is an intuitive knowledge. I am a neshama. I was brought from under the Kisei HaKavod, from under Hashem's throne of glory, put into this body, and there are things that instinctively I know. I don't need schooling immorality to know that it's wrong to kill, to murder, to steal. Instinctively, I know it. I can corrupt my nature. I can ignore it. But instinctively, I know that it's wrong to do these things. And intuitively, instinctively, I know that Hashem created, runs the world, and that Hashem is present. That's the first pillar of our emunah, an instinctive knowledge. The second pillar of our emunah is scientific knowledge. The Chovos Avovos explains that every day you should find something new in the Bria. Find something new in creation. Because he explains that wisdom in the creation is the most assured way to see a creator. When you study biology, when you study chemistry, when you study physics, and you see complex systems so deep and so vast, you say to yourself, oh my goodness, this is so beyond human comprehension, surely beyond human capacity. And you say to yourself, if this is the creation, what does it tell me about my creator? And the second pillar of our emunah is understanding, thinking, studying the world, looking at the complexity, looking at the systems. And this is something that also strengthens our emunah. But the third pillar of our emunah, and probably the most important, is the Mesorah. the fact that 3 million human beings stood at the base of Har Sinai and heard Hashem say the words, Anochi Hashem Elokecha. Those 3 million people told their children, who told their children, who told their children, and the Torah that we have, the Torah Shebiksav and the Torah Shebalpeh, has been handed down intact with complete veracity and emes. And when we study the events as told over to us by the Chumash, by the Rishonim, by the Gemara, what we have is a Masorah as to exactly what happened. And this is the third pillar of our Emunah. Experiencing it, reading it, understanding it. And the reality is that all three of these are necessary ingredients for a person to grow. You have to reach deep down into your instinct, into your gut, and experience Hashem. When you're davening, maybe on Shabbos, different times, you have to study the Bria. Maybe you shouldn't read the New York Times, but if you do, the Tuesday edition, the science section, is replete with wonders, layer after layer of complexity. And when you start reading and studying and seeing this vast world and the awesomeness of the systems involved, you say to yourself, oh my goodness, this is astonishing. And that's also something that requires work. But the third area that requires work is studying Chumash, learning it, understanding it, seeing the events as they happened. Rav Elchanan Wasserman in 1941 was in America collecting money. And it was becoming more and more obvious what was happening in Europe. And before he was going back, someone said to him, Rebbe, how could you go back there? It's suicide. And he said, I can't leave my flock. And apparently Rav Elchanan Wasserman knew what he was heading back to. He got on the boat, and when he arrived in Baranovich, he sat down in the yeshiva and he made one takana, Chumash, Chumash and Rashi. There are issues now with Emunah. There are issues now about seeing Hashem as the Borei Olam and the one who continues to run the world. And he instituted that the Bachram in the yeshiva should start learning Chumash, because when you learn Chumash, you see things differently. And for that reason, I say if you want to prepare for Pesach and if you want to use the Seder appropriately as it should be used, if you want to use Pesach as it should be used, you have to study Chumash. You have to open a Shmos, read it inside, preferably with Rashi. If you find it a little bit difficult to really dig in, there are many, many Svarim now. You can even use the Medrash says in English. Baruch Hashem, the Medrash is now accessible and available because we have various Svarim. We have many, many different formats. Use it. There's a 4-CD set. You see, it's Mitzrayim, Living Through the Makas. It's on the shmooze.com. You can get the CD set. It goes through in depth with the Rishonim, with the Achronim, with the Gemara, what was going on. But you have to spend time. You have to study the Chumash. You have to look at the events. You have to see what happens. Because when you do that, you begin experiencing it in a whole different way. And then when you sit down to Vigadat Labincha, it's a very different Vigadat Labincha. Then it's a Vigadat Labincha that you're experiencing, that you're living through, that you're actually engaging in. And so what I'd like to do is spend a little bit of time now, again, even though it's been recorded in other formats, and it is in the Chumash here, the parsha in depth earlier, but I want to spend a few minutes now on living through the Makas. We'll do a very sort of cursory glance, but we'll hit on some, hopefully some Chedushim that haven't been recorded in other places, and we'll give a sort of overview and then sort of try to focus a little bit. So let's begin with the following observation. The very first time that Moshe Rabbeinu appears in front of Paro, Paro says the words, Mi Hashem, Le'yadati Es Hashem, I don't know this God you're talking about, and I'm not sending the people out. The Rambam points out that it was one time and one time only that Paro said that. Because the first time when Moshe Rabbeinu came, he didn't perform the osos. He didn't perform initially the signs. But once Moshe Rabbeinu performed the signs to Paro, it was a different world. Because the Pasuk says that Paro, that Aaron's mate, Aaron's staff, swallowed up the staffs of all the Chartumim. What happened was that Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron HaKohen appear in the palace of Paro. Now, it wasn't so easy to get into the palace. Number one, they were armed guards. Number two, the Midrash says they were moats, various animals. This was a monarchy, a despot, who was very powerful. And you didn't just walk into the palace and say, hi, I'm here. Magically, somehow, through the lions and tigers, which were literally outside guarding, and through the moats that required either boats or drawbridges to get across, somehow Moshe and Aaron, these two majestic-looking old men, appear, long white beard. And remember that Moshe Rabbeinu had a tohar. Moshe Rabbeinu had an aura about him, almost a shine. And they stand in front of Paro, and they do the osos. They take the water thrown on the floor, turns into blood. Moshe Rabbeinu puts his hand in his shirt and brings it out to Tzaras. But it's the mata that's most intriguing. Because Moshe tells Aaron to throw the staff on the floor. He throws it on the floor, and it turns into a snake. At which point, Paro calls his chartumim and says, "Boys, come here." And the Medrash says he didn't call the advanced chartumim, he called the young chartumim, and said, "Guys, do the same." They threw their sticks on the floor, and it turned into snakes. Now, we spent time in an earlier parsha explaining that kishuf means a higher world knowledge. Western civilization is very sophisticated in technology, in applying science, physical science. Western man is very aware of and knows how to manipulate. In the ancient world, there were certain knowledges that man had that man no longer has. Every physical reality that Hashem created has a spiritual counterpart. Kishuf is a method of manipulating the upper world. Kishuf is not black magic in the sense of optical illusions, sleight of hands. When a magician in our world makes something disappear, we know what happened. The smoke and mirrors. It really is there. We just don't see it. That's an optical illusion. Achizas enayim. Kishuf, for which a chayiv misa, isn't an optical illusion. It's real. You really make the object disappear. How do you do it? If you know how to engage the spiritual world, and you know how to change things in the upper world, every physical reality has a spiritual counterpart. The only reason a rock is a rock is because Hashem created a malach that keeps it in existence, a spiritual counterpart. If you know how to mess with the upper world, you know how to change that spiritual reality, and the physical reality changes in suit. Paro called his chartumim, and they threw their sticks on the floor, and they too turned into snakes. At which point, Aaron takes the stick back, and it's again a stick. He picks up his serpent, and it's again a stick, and then he takes that stick, and he throws it on the floor, and as a stick, it swallows up every one of the other sticks, serpents. At which point, Paro said to himself, "Oh my goodness, this is not kishuf. This is way beyond." And Paro understood at that moment, explains Ramban, that he's not messing with a better mechashef. It's not somebody who knows black magic a little bit better than I do. Says Paro to himself, "What if he says to that stick to swallow me and my throne?" And the Ramban points out that you'll see from this moment on, never again does Paro say the words "Mi Hashem." Never again does Hashem say "Lo yadati es Hashem," because Paro knew with whom he was dealing. He wasn't willing to acquiesce. He wasn't giving in now. But the point is, it's a very different tone. And now what we're dealing with is a battle of will. And from this moment on, Paro, his servants, his people, are battling against Hashem, knowing, at least to a very real extent, with whom they're dealing. The first makkah is a pretty simple one. Now, Rashi explains that each makkah lasted approximately a month. There were 3 weeks of warning, 1 week of the actual plague. Moshe Rabbeinu comes to Paro in the morning. Paro made himself into an avodah zarah. He pretended that he didn't need the bathroom. He would go to the Nile in the morning when no one was looking. So Hashem says, go to him in the morning when he's real and warn him what's going to happen. Moshe Rabbeinu comes and says, "You see this boat that you're on? You see this Nile River that you're floating on? This will turn into blood." For 3 weeks straight, morning after morning, Moshe came to Paro and told him what will be. Paro didn't listen. Comes the day of the Makkah. Aaron takes his staff, hits the water, and the Nile River. But the Nile River doesn't mean a couple of ounces, a couple of gallons. If you look at the Hudson, billions and billions of gallons. The Nile River is a huge river. The entire river magically, instantly turns red. And all of the water that flowed out, Mitzrayim had no natural rain. The source of water in Mitzrayim that actually fed the crops and kept the civilization alive was all fed off of the Nile. all the tributaries throughout the entire Mitzrayim, everything that was fed from the Nile turned instantly into blood. But there's a very important point to recognize. And Sorno points out, Hadaga asher bayam mesu, the fish in the river died. The Sorno is bothered by, why do we need to know that? Why do we need to know that the fish died? Explains the Sorno, what the Torah is telling us is something very, very critical. Water is clear, odorless, and colorless. Blood is thick, globulous, and it smells. The water in the Nile didn't turn into painted water, colored water. The water in the Nile turned into blood with the thickness, the substance. It was literally dam. The fish in the river died because the gills that Hashem created process oxygen out of thin water that has a certain level of viscosity. When it became too thick, as in dam, their gills couldn't extract the oxygen and they died. And what every Mitzri saw clearly in front of them was a profound manifestation. That manifestation was that Hashem created water and keeps water. We, in our sophisticated knowledge, we think that water has a molecular structure, has a chemical structure, and that's what keeps it. What every human being at that moment saw was that water is clear, odorless, and colorless because Hashem created and maintains it. And the minute that Hashem says it should be otherwise, it will change. The molecular structure will change. The entire chemistry will change. Everything about it will change, because what every human being saw at that moment was that Hashem didn't just create the world. Hashem created the world and maintains every particle of physicality. And if for a split second Hashem would cease thinking of that part of the world, it would cease to exist. But you see, this wasn't a Nefesh HaChaim they were learning. This wasn't some highfalutin Musa Sefer that they tried to delve into. They saw it b'chush. That means the Mitzri was at the river, and he saw the river changed. And he saw that any water that was drawn from the river then or before was blood. If he had water in a cup, it was blood. If he had water gathered in a barrel in his house, it was blood. Any water that came from the Nile turned into blood no matter where it was. And as the Medrash explained, how the Mitzrim find water, they bought it from the Jews. If a Mitzri bought water from the Jews with the full payment, then in fact it turned from blood to water. And I don't know if we have the time to really play out the illustration, but imagine that Yitzhak and Muhammad are standing there in the field. And Yitzhak is drinking a cup of clear water that he just drew from the Nile. And Muhammad says, "Come here, boy. What's that in your hand?" "It's water, sir." "Give me that cup, boy." And Yitzhak hands the cup of water to Muhammad. And as it transfers from Yitzhak's hands to Muhammad, it turns from water to blood. "Take that back." And Muhammad gives it back to Yitzhak. And as it transfers from Muhammad's hand to Yitzhak, it turns back from blood to water. "Go back, back and forth, back, blood, water, back and forth, back and forth." "Oh my goodness, what does this mean?" Until Muhammad reaches into his pocket, pulls out the money for it, and pays for it. Then when he takes the cup, it remains water. And then when he says to Yitzhak, "Okay, boy, now give me back the money," when he took back the money, the water in the cup turned back to blood. What was he thinking? What were the Jewish people thinking? What they were doing was experiencing Hashem as the creator and maintainer of physicality. They were living through the greatest manifestation of Hashem's hand that you could ever envision. And it wasn't theory. It wasn't something that we'll read about in the Beis Medrash. It was something that they lived, that they experienced. And each makkah lasted for 7 days. They had enough time for it to sink in. After 7 days, the water turned back to water. No longer blood, but now water. Then comes Sfardeya. The Pasuk says, 8 Sfardeya, single Sfardeya, came out of the Nile. Now, you may say to yourself, one Sfardeya over an entire nation like Mitzrayim does not sound very threatening. Rashi brings down the Medrash that one large frog marched out of the Nile and headed straight for Paro's palace. At which point the guards saw this makkah, they saw this frog, they knew about the warning, they took their sticks and they smashed it. That one large frog split into two. So they smashed that one, and that one split into two. They smashed the next one, it split, hit, split, hit, split, hit, split, hit, split, until you had billions and billions and billions of frogs covering Mitzrayim. Now the stipler in Chai Olam asks an interesting question. Imagine that you're the guard. Frog marches up out of Nile, heads to Paro's palace, you see it, you hit it, and it splits. That's pretty strange. So you hit one of those splits, and it too splits. And you try it one more time and another time. After a while, you get the idea. Every time I hit this frog, it doesn't die. It actually splits into two. So why did the guards stop after, let's say, four or five times? Now, imagining a country as large as Mitzrayim with 16 frogs, it doesn't sound like a very great affliction. Why did they just stop? Explains the stipler, these frogs would attack, they would jump, they couldn't help but hit, split. And throughout Mitzrayim, they kept spreading and spreading and spreading. If you sat, hit, split. If you moved your arm, hit, split. Throughout Mitzrayim, a single house contained thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds, wherever you sat, wherever you opened the drawer, wherever you went, as you lie down in bed. And if you could imagine 7 days of ribbit, jumping and moving and hit, split. And the more you hit them, the more they split. And you begin to appreciate something. Es asher hisalalti b'mitzrayim. Hashem said to Moshe, I'm playing with the Mitzrayim. If you notice, especially in the beginning, the makas aren't very, very harsh. They're not very tough. Blood, frogs, cute. As a matter of fact, at the Seder table, we play. We play frogs, we play turn the water into blood with Kool-Aid. It's humorous, right? And it's exactly what Hashem was saying. I'm going to play with the Mitzrayim. They're not opponents. Paro is not my enemy, Hashem says, that I have to fight. I'm going to play to demonstrate that I am the creator and one who maintains physicality. And if you can imagine billions and billions of frogs spreading throughout Mitzrayim, and if you could imagine these frogs doing things that were highly unnatural, jumping into ovens that a frog normally wouldn't do, jumping down people's throats, something a frog don't normally do, and living inside the body of the Mitzri. And you'll excuse me for repeating this, I've done this in different times, but let's imagine we have Muhammad. And he's got the score. It's day three of the Makkah. He knows it's going to last seven more days, and he knows that one of his buddies just swallowed a frog. And he knows that the frog is in his stomach, ribbit, and Muhammad says to himself, it ain't happening to me. He shuts his mouth, and he spends the next 24 hours gripping his teeth and not allowing any frog to dare enter his mouth. And he's a tough guy, and he's doing very well. Until day five, when he wakes up in the morning, and he looks up on his windowsill and he sees a frog. Muhammad goes right and the frog goes right. Muhammad goes left and the frog goes left. Muhammad moves back and the frog moves forward. Oh my goodness, I'm being stalked by Kermit. You're not getting down my throat, Muhammad says. And he is darn determined that nothing is going to happen. No frog is coming down my throat. During breakfast, he's okay. He eats with one hand over his mouth and kind of gobbles the food. By lunch, it's a little bit tougher. Keep in mind, he probably hasn't slept in 4 or 5 days now because with frogs jumping and ribbiting, and he's getting weary and dragging, you stupid frog! Ribbit. And for the next 2 days, Muhammad's got Kermit in his stomach. What the Jewish people saw, what the Mitzrim saw, was that Hashem is the creator and one who maintains physicality, who orchestrates this world, who's present in every part of the world, who runs the world. And what the Jews and the Mitzrim saw was Ani Hashem. But it wasn't enough. We're now 2 months into the storyline. Now we start Kinim. Lice. Also not so bad. Little lice. So let me clue you into what lice are. Lice are these tiny little bugs that just love to dig their little feet into the hair follicles, right? Each hair on your hand, on your arm, grows out of a tiny little space there, and the hair follicle kind of is the very, very base of it. They love to dig their feet in. They love to plant their eggs in there. And if you can imagine your entire head, body, every inch of skin covered with these crawling, stupid, creepy things. Ah! Three tefachim deep. If you dug down into the ground, there was no ground there, no dirt. Three tefachim, 12 inches deep, there was kinim, lice. As a matter of fact, Medrash tells us during this Makkah, land battles between Mitzrayim and its neighbors were settled. Why? Because the Torah says that Mitzrayim, the land of Mitzrayim, will turn into kinim, only the land of Mitzrayim. And like a laser cutting out the border, if the land belonged to Mitzrayim, it turned into lice. If it didn't belong to Mitzrayim, it remained dirt. And if you can imagine every table, every chair, every bed, everywhere you went, the walls, the coverings, everything covered with these creepy things, lice and lice. You can't lie down, you can't sit down. They're creeping on your arms and your legs and your skin, and you're just itching and itching. After not a very long time, there was no business done in Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim was an agricultural society. They lived off the wealth of the land, cattle, crops, etc. Each one of the Makkahs became more deep, more penetrating, and after a while there was nothing to do. The crops were destroyed, the livestock were destroyed, and the Mitzrayim had a lot of time on their hands. A lot of time for them to dwell, to think, to contemplate what's going on. What's happening here? And they lived through month after month after month, and for the most part, the vast majority of them remained kofrim, denied Hashem. And by Arba, it wasn't much better. By Choshech, it wasn't much different either. Let me share with you one of the questions my son, when he was a little guy, asked me. Choshech didn't last 7 days. It lasted only 6 days. The first 3 days, it was pitch black for the Mitzrayim. Pitch black. Couldn't see a thing. The Jews went into the Mitzrayim's houses to ask to find out where the hiding places were for the gold and the silver, because Hashem promised Avram that when the Jewish people leave, they're going to leave Berechush Gadol with great wealth. For 210 years, their labor was stolen from them. It was forced enslavement. All of the wealth of Mitzrayim by right belonged to the Jews, and Hashem promised that when the Jewish people leave, they'll leave with that wealth that they're entitled to. And before they leave Mitzrayim, the Jews asked the Mitzrayim, do you have any gold? Do you have any silver? No, we don't. Well, what about that in your drawer? What about that hiding over there? How did the Jews know where the gold and silver was hiding? Because during the first 3 days of Choshech, Moshe told the Jewish people, go around to your neighbors, find their hiding places. Find where they hide their precious gold, their jewels, etc. Because there will come a time not long from now when you're going to ask for it and leave with it. So during the first 3 days, if you're in Mitzri, it's very, very dark, pitch black, and all of a sudden you hear a creaking of a door. Who is that? Who is it? Oh, Muhammad, it's me, Yitzhak. Hey, where are you? Oh, it's okay. Draw opening, draw closing. What are you doing? It's like, oh, don't worry, Muhammad, it's okay. That's for 3 days. Pitch black, total blackness for the Mitzri, while the Jew has absolute clarity of sight. That's interesting. But then, Vayamesh Choshech, the next 3 days, Rashi explains, it wasn't just dark, it was substance to the thickness. If a Mitzri was sitting, he remained sitting. If he was up on a ladder, he remained up on a ladder. Whatever position he was in, he was frozen in. Now, I may have given away a little bit of the answer, but when my son was little, he asked me, he said, Abba, I don't get it. If it was dark, it was dark. But let's imagine Mitzri climbs up the ladder, and it's very dark. Let him let go and he'll fall to the ground. Why does he have to stay up there on the ladder? If he's sitting down, why can't he stand? Why can't he stand? Why can't he move? And the Ramban explains that there was a thickness to the air that was so substantive that you couldn't move. Imagine thick jello, but more intense than that. They physically couldn't move. There was Vayamesh Choshech, there was substance. The Sun explains the first 3 days, there's a property in the air that Hashem said, you shall not allow light to pierce. the air became thick in the sense that light could not pierce it. Light rays normally spread. They penetrate air which has no resistance to it. And Hashem says that will change. And the light couldn't penetrate the darkness for the mitzvah, but for the Jews it could. Go explain that one. But that was the first 3 days. The next 3 days, the darkness intensified to such an extent that it was thick. And so thick that if you had one arm up in the air and one arm down, that's how you remained for three days. You couldn't move. And whatever position the mitzvah was in, the air was so thick that it remained glued to that place. So my son asked me the question, if so, how'd the mitzvah breathe? If the air was so thick that it couldn't even move their arms, how'd they breathe? So I said to him, that's a neis. That's a miracle. But you hear what I'm saying? What the mitzvah, what the Jews, what the generation lived through was the greatest revelation that Hashem is the creator. Hashem is the one who orchestrates, and Hashem is in charge of the world. V'yadatem ki ani Hashem. They knew from this that Hashem is Hashem. And astonishingly, they lived through Makas Bchoros, where the firstborn died, and studied the Rashis, how each house, in Bayis Hashem, in Shamais, every house had a death. If it was a Bechor, firstborn, he died. If not, the oldest child died. If not, the oldest person in the house died. Each house, Rashi explained, some houses had many deaths because the Mitzri women were promiscuous. They had many children from each one, the firstborn from a different father. And what that Mitzri woman saw clearly was that Hashem was there. Hashem was watching, recording. And Hashem is the Balabas. Finally, after that Makkah, the Mitzrim say, get out. Paro comes, Vayakam, Paro Balayla. Paro himself gets up at night and says, get out of here, Kulanu Mason, get out. And they try to kick the Jewish nation out at night. Moshe says, we're not leaving like thieves in the night. In the morning, we'll leave. And the entire Jewish nation, 600,000 men between the age of 20 and 60, take their belongings, take their cows, take their cattle, and take their sheep, take everything they have, and march out. The nation that bragged that not a single slave ever escaped, an entire nation, 3 million people, march out into the desert, guided by the Ane Esh, a pillar of fire that lights up the darkness as if it's day, surrounded on each side by clouds. The clouds beautifully pave the way. The clouds protect them from the elements, climate controlled. Normally in the Midbar it's hot, dry, not for the Jewish people. Comfort, climate controlled, perfectly guiding them. And they begin marching out, guided by these Anonim, guided by these powerful, powerful pillars. And they begin the march, initially to Eretz Yisrael, at least in their minds, to go to the Holy Land. And they begin the march, and after 6 days, they realize something's not going right. The pasuk says that Hashem turned them around, and Hashem turned them around in a way that they should end up in a place where they didn't need to be. But after 3 days, the reports come back to Paro. You see, Paro sent out spies, and the spies followed for 3 days, and when they saw that the Jewish nation were turning the wrong way, the spies began coming back. They came back and told Paro the Jewish nation are lost in the Midbar. Paro tells his people, let's go. Paro takes his chariot himself, hitches up his own horses, and he says, I'm leading the way. We'll split the bizui, we'll split the booty. Let's go. And he and his army, what was left of it, followed and took chase. Now at this point, things begin to get very, very intriguing. Because if you can imagine, Paro leading the chase with his chariots behind him and all of his army, and the Jewish nation see Mitzrayim Nosei. They see Mitzrayim coming after them. And as the Mitzrayim come close to approaching the Jewish nation now are backed up against the Yam. Against their back is the Yam Suf. They can't proceed because there's this ocean behind them. And they see Mitzrayim coming. They see the armies. They see their masters. Then Ezra explains that by all rights, the Jews probably, they certainly outnumbered the Mitzrayim. They should have been able to easily vanquish him. They left chamushim, they left armed. But then Ezra explains that these were their masters. The Jewish people were slaves. This generation were born into servitude. They looked at the Mitzrim as superior beings. They couldn't imagine fighting them. And they were racked with terror. And then they saw the Anan Esh, the cloud of fire that had led them, move from the front of them to the back and stopped the Mitzrim from advancing. Now, folks, if you've ever flown in a plane and you see that it gets very misty outside, you know that you're flying through a cloud. Clouds are things that planes fly through. You walk through them. On a foggy day, you just walk through the clouds. This cloud was a little different. This cloud not only lit up the night like it was day, it stopped the Mitzrim in their track. And they stopped like a wall. They tried to fire arrows, wouldn't penetrate. Fire arrows wouldn't penetrate. The entire night, they stayed in place. And then the Ramban says something compelling. He says that Hashem split the Yam with the Ruach Kadim Aza. The Pasuk describes that Hashem split the Yam Suf with an eastern wind, a powerful eastern wind. Ask the Ramban, why is it that Hashem split the Yam with an eastern wind? If Hashem wants to split the sea, Hashem could do it any which way. Explain the Ramban that the Midrash tells us that what happened was some point during that night, the wind started blowing. Wind started blowing across this vast expanse of the Yam. Imagine you have an ocean, miles and miles and miles wide, stretching out as far as your eye can see. Slowly that night, the wind starts blowing, starts blowing, starts blowing, and slowly, as it blows stronger and stronger, you see across the vast expanse almost an etching out, a line here, a line there, a line there. And as the night wears on, the wind becomes stronger, and those etches in the water start becoming deeper, almost like a furrow, almost like something cut out. And as the night wears on more, the etchings become deeper and deeper until you see something actually cutting through. And you start seeing segments, 12 segments, and the wind keeps howling, and the segments get deeper and deeper, and as the night continues on, until finally there are 12 separate partitions cut out in the Yam. Now let's do the math. If there are 3 million people, and each shevet is going to go in its own path, you're dealing with not a little alleyway. If you imagine you have 100,000 people having to pass through 200,000 people, 250,000, somewhere in that range, each of these pathways were wide. And the ocean bottom, which is normally muck and mire, is smooth. And each shevet is able to see one shevet to the next. Because when Reuven is going through channel number 1 and Levi is in channel number 3, Hashem was afraid that what if Levi doesn't see Reuven? They're going to think that they drowned. So you could see from channel to channel to channel to channel all the way straight through. Even though normally water is very, very dark and blocks the light, especially when we're dealing with hundreds of feet, maybe thousands of feet deep, you're able to see it. And if you can imagine channels that run all the way to the ocean depth, I don't know the exact depth of the Yam Suf, but I know that the oceans run to 20,000, 25,000, 30,000 feet of depth. If you can imagine a wall from the ocean floor, hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands of feet tall, standing strong, a pillar, solid, cut directly where it's supposed to be. And at a certain point, Hashem says to Moshe Rabbeinu, you don't have to cry, you don't have to ask. The Klai Yisrael just should walk, and the Klai Yisrael enter the Yam Suf, each shevet in its own channel. They begin the march. And when each shevet gets about to the midpoint, at that point the Anan Esh that was blocking the Mitzrim lifts up, and the Egyptians saw. What they saw in front of them was 12 partitions, each shevet in its own, each of them deeply submerged in what are clear channels with walls marched out. And what did the Mitzrim do? With Paro at their lead, Paro said the words, "Charge! Let's go!" And they chased the Jews down into these channels. And the Jewish people began walking out. Now at this point, running toward an escape when the last of the Jews exited on the other side. That's when the nice, smooth, firm ground turned mucky and back to mire. And then it hardened and the chariots became fixed in their places. The hooves of the horses became fixed. And at that point, the Mitzrim looked up hundreds, maybe thousands of feet high, saw these pillars of water, and at that moment, they came crashing down, and every Mitzri was annihilated. But the Ramban asks, so why did Hashem split it with an eastern wind? And the Ramban explains why. He explains so that the Mitzrim should have something to be tole it on. They should have something to hang their hat on. They should be able to say, ah, it's not Hashem, it's not God, it's the eastern wind, explains Ramban, even though, of course, the wind doesn't normally do this. But even this they didn't want to accept because of Rov Tavasam L'Ralahem, because of a tremendous desire to hurt the Jews. And what the Ramban is sharing with us is a profound illustration of a force that Hashem created that is unintelligible. And that force is something called free will. You see, Bechira doesn't mean that a human being can be intelligent and choose poorly. Free will means the ability to be free to choose exactly what I want. I don't drink bleach. I won't put my hand in a fire. If you pay me $1,000, I would not walk into a furnace because it's foolish, it's damaging. Do I have free will to drink bleach? My free will to burn myself? In theory, I do, but that's not Bechira. To allow for actual, practical free will, Hashem put blinders into man. Hashem allowed a human being to believe exactly what he wants. Hashem allowed a person to stare into the ball of the sun and say it doesn't exist. And Hashem allowed the Mitzrim to live through month after month of the most clear revelation of Hashem's presence and then see Kriyas Yamsov and say the words, charge! What do you mean, charge? Just, of course, charge. It's only the eastern wind. The wind did it. It's not God. It's the wind. And the Ramban a little bit earlier says, of all the makas, this is the greatest mofes. This is the greatest miracle that the Mitzrim would actually do this. He says it's a shigayon, it's an insanity. And if you think about it, that's exactly what it is. It's an insanity because, again, to allow for free will, Hashem gave us this ability. Hashem gave us this koach, this ability to believe or not to believe, to accept or not to accept, because that ultimately allows for real free will, practical free will. And the point that a Jew has to understand is that emunah is something that we grow with. Emunah is something that requires constant focusing on, constant improving. Just because you learned something when you were 6 years old in cheder, and just because you knew something once, doesn't mean you're living it. And all of these mitzvahs surrounding Yetzias Mitzrayim, reminding us of them, is because we have to constantly feel it, constantly reinvigorate ourselves with the understanding and to see Hashem more clearly. Ultimately, that is the mitzvah of Igarat L'Bincha. Ultimately, that's the mitzvah of Yedata, knowing Hashem. Ultimately, that's the purpose, the Ramban explains, of all the mitzvahs, to see Hashem. And Pesach, again, is ideally a time to do just that. But you have to take the time to study the events, to study Chumash properly.